This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Department of Children and Families is under intense scrutiny on Beacon Hill today as lawmakers probe the circumstances surrounding the death of 14-year-old David Almond. Almond died in October of last year, 7 months after DCF returned him to his father's home. David, who was intellectually disabled, was allegedly starved and abused by his father and his father's girlfriend, all while under the watch of the Department of Children and Families and other agencies. Since 2014, five children who were involved with or under the care of the Department of Children and Families have died. Testifying before lawmakers earlier today, DCF Commissioner Linda Spears recognized Almond's death as a tragedy and a systems failure, but defended the agency as a whole.
We have reduced the number of children who are re-abused in the state of Massachusetts between 2015 and now by almost 40%. It's a significant change in our ability to make safety. It did not protect David Almond, but it protected a whole lot of other kids.
The circumstances, nevertheless, have the Joint Committee on Children, Families, and Persons with Disabilities asking today, how did we get here again? To help us ask and answer that question, we are joined by Mary McGowan, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Mary, thanks for joining us today. Mary, it is a tragedy, and it's one that has happened multiple times now. What is going on? How does a child slip through the cracks like this?
Well, first of all, I mean, this is a tragedy. I've, you know, been doing this work for more than 25 years, and reading this report was difficult. It was devastating. There was more than one time I needed to put the report down and walk away from it. I think, you know, when back a year ago, when the pandemic was really shutting everything down, there were many of us in this community who worried about what would happen to children. And I was one. I worried about the kids who were on nobody's radar screen, the ones we didn't know about. I think what was so upsetting and tragic when you read this case is we knew this boy. We knew him. We knew his brothers. There were people involved, there were agencies involved, and still we let him down. And
how does that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And the one thing I also will say though is the idea that the last 6 years nobody has been working really hard to improve and enhance the Department of Children and Families, it is not true. I mean, you mentioned the tragedies of the past. And historically, when there's a tragedy in the Department of Children and Families, there's a ton of media attention and there's hearings and stakeholders get involved. And then the attention fades. That hasn't happened over the course of the last 6 years. There has been a tremendous investment in terms of budget, in terms of staffing, reducing caseloads, looking at policies, impacting the infrastructure. There's been a ton of work and progress has been made, and there's still a ton of work to do. And I keep saying, if I could change one thing, it's this idea that we're going to reform the Department of Children and Families, because that implies that there's an end date, and there will never be a moment where we're all going to just go, mission accomplished, we've done everything, because the needs of kids, the needs of families, and what's happening in our communities is ever changing. And we need a child welfare system that's going to respond and be nimble and be able to address those changes. So that's what didn't happen in this case. The agencies involved, which included the Department of Children and Families, education, other providers, there was a lot of information that they were sharing and talking about these kids and families, but nobody knit it together. Nobody looked at it and said, wait a minute, what is this telling us? There was the Department of Children and Families was, in my opinion, checking off boxes. They weren't looking at the information critically and thinking about, what does that tell us about what's going on in these boys' lives? What does it tell us about the relationship between the caretakers and the kids? Nobody was looking at it critically and saying, what do we know and what do we need to do?
So I want to, there's a lot in what you've just said. And I think the thread that I want to pick up on, Mary, is that suggests to me that there are technical reforms that maybe there, it sounds like you are saying there have been some improvements on in the last 6 years. But if I listen to you, I think what I hear you saying is that there is a mindset reform, an orientation that is missing, that means that there's nobody watching the picture as a whole, and that that needs to change. Am I hearing you correctly, or am I going, you know, a step further than you're meaning to in your comments?
No. I think, and I think in a very crystal clear way, you're embracing what is the most important part of this conversation, which is there does need to be a real recognition that we're in this to keep kids safe. And if we start every conversation, every discussion with what's in the best interest of this child, then I do believe it changes the way all of the other actors contribute and make decisions. So it's a culture change. It's a little bit of you know, remembering why we get into this business. I mean, when I look at some parts of this report, and I'm going to focus right now on the role of the juvenile court.
Just to clarify for our listeners, the report by the Office of the Child Advocate and its investigation after the death of David Almond, correct?
Yes. So this is, again, a report that lays out, holds nothing back in what the failures of the system were. When I look at what happened in the juvenile court, so again, when a child is removed from their birth family, the Department of Children and Families is required to report to the court about what's going on in terms of why that decision was made, what the plan for the child is it to go home to their birth families, is it one of adoption? And it's the court that is sort of playing that role of listening to all the information, I would suggest should be asking critical questions and then making determinations about what the next step would be. In this particular case, David and his brothers, their care and protection, the decision about should they go home or should they be adopted, was in the court for 24 months. And they didn't know what was going to happen to them, where they would be going, where they were going to live, who that lifelong connection was going to be made for them. And my point is, these are kids. And 2 years in the life of a child is a lifetime. And part of what we need to be thinking about, and as we're looking at this case, is how do we begin to shift the conversation so that we're making good decisions, taking the information, asking the tough questions, and at the same time, attaching an urgency to it so that we're moving children into a situation that promotes their health, their well-being, and really gives them an opportunity to grow and have what we all want for our kids, to be able to go to school, to be able to make friends, and to be able to have a life.
So I want to clarify, in this case, you mentioned the brothers. There were four boys involved, triplets and a half-brother. One of the brothers refused to go back into care with the parents, and the parents had been found unfit, or at least the father had been found unfit multiple times before 2017. So I understand your point about the orientation toward the child and the culture set, but this just also feels like broken systems. Maybe I just want to be satisfied by you being able to say, yep, if we had done just X differently. But this does feel like there must have been technical failures along the way as well.
Where I absolutely agree with you is there are failures and technical, but it's, I mean, there were so many opportunities that if one decision was made differently, the result may have been different. I say that, you know, you mentioned multiple times that the decision was made that the father was not fit to parent. Not only multiple times, but on July 10th, 2000, I have to look at the report, but on one particular day, the dad is found unfit. And the very next day, the reunification plan for the triplets, the boys, is changed from adoption to reunification. That makes no sense. And I think across the board, whether it's the child advocate, the state agency, the commissioner, the secretary, it's indefensible. And I haven't come across anybody who has tried to defend it. It is a decision that nobody can explain. I look at it and think people didn't look at the information that was in front of them. They didn't ask critical questions. They weren't even curious. And it was a complete and utter failure.
The last part of this happened in 2020 during the pandemic. I should ask you, can this case, this particular tragedy, be attributed to the challenges of staying connected with children and families during the pandemic? One must at least ask that question.
I think it contributed. I don't think it was the singular reason. And it certainly contributed because we know in reading the report that both the father and his girlfriend used the pandemic multiple times to really prevent individuals from entering the home and seeing the boys and seeing the living conditions that the family was living in. So they used the concern that they had been exposed or that somebody was sick. And as a result, staff did not go into the house. So it contributed. And it certainly in those early days and months, March, April, and May, where, agencies, PPE was scarce, schools were trying to figure out what remote learning looked like. Again, those early days, it would have had an impact. However, certainly as you go into late spring and early summer, there was enough red flags that you would have expected that this family would be prioritized, these boys would be prioritized. When you read the report, there's descriptions of David being completely nonverbal on a Zoom call. And you just had to look at the record, and that wasn't consistent with the 14-year-old boy who had arrived there in March. He was funny, he was engaging. And nobody asked the question, is he okay? And people, the staff, DCF, others, took his lack of communication, his body language, as a sign of his disability. He was autistic, and not a sign of a young boy in distress. Those are missed opportunities, and they should have been picked up on.
And that raises the question about, and I know DCF is taking some action on the question of its expertise in working with children who have intellectual developmental disabilities and families where there are disabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's one, and the data is pretty clear that if a child has a disability, they are much more likely to be abused or neglected. So that is a skill set that should and needs to be embedded in the Department of Children and Families. The other really gets to the assessment of parents to be able to care for their children. And again, that is a glaring deficiency in this report. And I too have heard the commissioner and others say that is an area that they're going to be focusing on. But the idea that nobody bothered to look at these parents and ask, do they have the skill sets to be able to care for these kids? Do they have the supports? And we know that there were requests for certain services to come into the home, wait lists prevented it from happening, and yet still the children are returned home, despite the fact that the very services that were identified were not available. So there needs to be a real robust and aggressive way of making sure that when we have children who have complex needs, that we make sure that the families, the parents, the caretakers are equipped to be able to care for them.
All right. In a sentence, what is the very next step and who needs to take it?
Very next step. The very next step, I think, is for DCF to embrace the role they have to keep kids safe. However, they need to do it in a manner that pulls together all the agencies that are engaged with kids' lives, education, healthcare, behavioral healthcare, pull them together and really play that role of what do we know and how do we make sure we're developing the best plans for these kids and families and following through on them.
Mary McGowan is the executive director of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Mary, thanks. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The latest front in the battle over police reform is Twitter. The parties involved, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association and Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Andrea Campbell. The exchange began after the Boston Herald reported that Campbell was holding up $1.2 million in police funds. In response to the story, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association tweeted they were astonished, quote, given the recent explosion of violence in our city, end quote. Campbell responded that she was still waiting to hear from the BPPA, quote, on why they enabled and elevated an accused child molester, end quote, referring to the former president of the union, Patrick Rose, who has been charged with molesting multiple children. In response, the BPPA replied, quote, people who live in glass houses, end quote, should refrain from talking about, quote, enabling criminals. Now, this was widely seen as a veiled reference to Campbell's brother, Alvin R. Campbell Jr., who has been charged with multiple accounts of sexual assault. A number of elected officials have expressed outrage over the Boston Police Patrolmen Association's attack. We reached out several times to them to comment or join us on the show, but they did not respond. Councillor Campbell, however, joined us earlier today to give us her take on the incident, and she began by recalling how she first reacted.
I think I continued doing the work, right? There's still a lot more work to do to ensure our police department is the most transparent, diverse, and accountable in the country. And for me, it's always been about focusing on the work and getting things done on behalf of the residents we have the honor and privilege of serving. I was disappointed, of course, that they would go personal and be unprofessional, but I don't let it get distract me from doing what's necessary in terms of the work.
There was a strong reaction, and a number of public officials, including several women of color, have condemned the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association for that tweet and for other tweets. That includes Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey, who is your competitor in the mayoral race. They pointed to the personal nature, which you just referred to, of the attack and suggested that it follows a pattern from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association directed at elected women of color. How do you see it?
I agree. You know, the attack was definitely personal and unprofessional, but sadly, it wasn't shocking because it is a pattern from this particular union to come out with direct attacks directed towards women and electeds of color, particularly when we disagree. And for me, it's really important in this moment in time that I keep to the issues and that there is tremendous work to do to ensure our department continues to be transparent and more accountable, which right now that's not the case. And there are so many examples, whether it's the Patrick Rose case, whether or not an officer participated in the Capitol insurrection, this recent officer, McHale, who of course was caught on body camera bragging about running over protesters who now possibly has some sexual allegations against him. There are a whole host of examples as to why it is critically important that none of us, including residents, take our eye off the work of ensuring that this department does better in terms of transparency and accountability. And that's my job, and that's what I'll continue to focus on.
Do you see tweets like these as part of the larger reform picture?
Absolutely. If anything, I think this bargaining unit continues to lose credibility with the public and with many officers. You know, at what point do the rank and file members stand up and say that the leadership no longer reflects their values? And I also think about all the hardworking city employees across every department in the city who see this and have concerns as well. And so I think for me, the reforms continue to be about transparency, accountability, ensuring that we also have a department that is diverse. I've been pushing for years for more women and people of color to join our department, to be promoted in the ranks, and that our department also takes the lead on rooting out racial injustices and racial disparities in our policing model. All of that work is important, but it cannot happen if we refuse to challenge this union in particular, and the leadership of this union that would continue to go there in terms of personal attacks.
Have you heard anything from the rank and file about this particular exchange?
Folks have reached out, a whole range of folks, and left messages, frankly, words of encouragement to keep going. And I've told them I'm not going to get distracted because there is incredible work to do. Not, of course, not only in terms of policing reform, responding to issues of COVID, dealing with the opioid crisis in the city of Boston, which frankly is getting worse, including at Mass and Cass and some of our downtown neighborhoods, our Boston public schools. This is not the time to be distracted. And I'm one who's always worked in such a way that I have the ability to focus on the work and to continue to move the work forward.
I want to engage with you more on the policy. Before we do, I have one last question for you about this exchange. What about those who argue that fair is fair in this exchange? You took a shot at the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association about the Patrick Rose case, and then they took a shot back at you. What is your response to that argument?
I kept it about the issues. And the issue was the Patrick Rose case, which is a horrific case where we have a former officer who, based on certain accounts, committed child molestation and was allowed to stay in our police department for decades, was allowed to engage with children, was allowed to move up in the ranks and become the leader of the patrolmen's union. They were nowhere to be found in terms of a response calling out how horrendous and horrific that case was. And I was calling that out. They're a major stakeholder. They're a bargaining unit with the city of Boston. And they were absolutely silent on the Patrick Rose case. I kept it about the issues. It is unfortunate that there are some hateful individuals, including whoever wrote that tweet, that want to try to use my pain and trauma as a weapon against me. Because I've always made it clear that this work of being a public servant has always been about breaking cycles of poverty, criminalization, and trauma, not just for my family, but for many others in the city of Boston. And I know there are many residents in our city that can relate to the stigma and the shame that comes when you have a family member that is incarcerated. And I have always been open about those experiences and how that pushes me to turn pain into purpose.
What do you want from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association about the Patrick Rose case? What information or statement or documents do you want from the BPPA?
In addition to calling it out as the horrific case it is, them to be more transparent about the role of the union and his leadership in the union during this time, who was engaging with him, do they have any knowledge of what was going on? In addition, I want the union to also be pushing for accountability. I have been public talking about the need for an external investigation here. They can be doing the same to push for that accountability that every resident in the city of Boston deserves with respect to this case. And I'm calling for an external investigation that would involve the U.S. Attorney's Office. Others can be calling for the same. And I think it's critically important given the magnitude and the seriousness of this case and the ramifications.
All right, so let's back up. Before the exchange turned personal, it began with the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association raising questions about police funding. The Boston Herald reported about the City Council, a committee under your leadership, slowing down $1.2 million in funding. That's the City Council's Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice. Did you slow down that $1.2 million in funding? And if so, why?
I have no problem releasing grants out of my committee to our department. Just this past Wednesday, I did just that. I released a grant that we received in order to serve a certain purpose in the department where I got adequate information about how those monies would be used. These two particular grants, and it is rare that I have kept grants under review for a period of time, but these two particular grants are troubling. They point to racial disparities within the BRIC, the gang database. Residents, advocates showed up at the hearing to bring forth information about some concerning patterns with respect to practices within the BRIC that are leading to some of these racial disparities and surveillance. And so I have asked a lot of questions, and I'm still waiting on the department to respond with meaningful information with respect to these grants. And I've yet to get that, and I'm going to keep pushing them. That's why they're under review. But I'm also pushing back on this narrative. The police department has a budget that is over $400 million in a ballooning overtime budget that is $70 million in rising. It is not sustainable, and it's definitely not sustainable coming out of COVID when we have to be conservative in our budgeting. And so I push back on this narrative that to respond to incidents of violence in the city of Boston, we have to keep giving millions of dollars to an overtime budget. That is not the case. I'm actually the only candidate with a plan that would not only reallocate money from that ballooning overtime budget, but would redirect it so that every district and every neighborhood has adequate coverage for officers to be able to respond to what the calls are that they're receiving, and at the same time address the root causes of violence, which also has to happen at the same time, because police alone cannot solve issues of violence by themselves in the city of Boston.
So staying with this for a minute longer for our listeners, the $1.2 million in question, it was $850,000 to, you said, the BRIC, that stands for the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, the gang database is what it's often known as. The other was $300,000 to fund a partnership between the Boston Police Department's Youth Violence Strike Force and the State Police Gang Unit. Are you fundamentally calling into question these programs? And is that, what could you hear that would change your mind and release the funding to these two programs? Or is there something fundamental to which you object?
All of us agree, including our former mayor and the administration and folks at the BRIC as well and the department, that there are racial disparities in our policing and including in the BRIC, in the gang database, in the gang unit. And there have been residents, lawyers, many advocates, so many folks who have shown up with specific examples that highlight those inequities. What I want to see from this department is a willingness not only to acknowledge they exist, but to put forth a plan and a strategy to eliminate and eradicate those racial inequities, to create a department that is more transparent and accountable and diverse, and a department that is, frankly, the leading department in this nation when it comes to transparency and accountability. That's what I want for our city, and that's what I'm going to keep pushing for as chair of public safety, and that's exactly what I would push for as the mayor of the city of Boston.
So my last question to you, Councillor, tries to look at the complexity of this particular situation. You are running for mayor. You have been open, as you said to me just a few minutes ago, about both your view that the system has failed your brothers and also the personal nature of your family's relationship with the criminal justice system, losing Andre at age 29, the accusations against Alvin, who is accused of assaulting women, and you speaking out for women who made those accusations. Now this exchange with the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, who, if you were mayor, you would be in negotiations with, as you note, in future labor contracts. How does one navigate the complexity of that situation in this moment?
I frankly have been navigating it for years. I started on the council as the chair of the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice, pushing for the implementation, for example, of body cameras after the city agreed to implement that program. Pushing for, of course, the Civilian Review Board, pushing for greater diversity. It has not been easy along the way. There have been different attacks here and there that weren't maybe so public. But for me, I do not allow that to stand in the way of the work I feel called to do in this moment, which it goes back to my personal story of having such incredible loss, losing my parents, brothers, siblings, cousins to the criminal justice system. In saying that, my life story itself is an example of how we can break cycles of poverty, criminalization, and trauma in the city of Boston. I got everything it would take to do that from this city that I love. And now my job is to make sure that every family in the city of Boston has access to the same opportunity to be able to break those cycles for their families. And each of us has a role to play in making that happen.
That is City Councilor and Boston mayoral candidate Andrea Campbell. Councilor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Herd immunity. That has been the stated goal from very early on in the pandemic. It's the tipping point where enough of us are protected from the coronavirus to allow all of us safely to resume some normal life. But is herd immunity attainable? Will enough people get vaccinated? Will travel patterns expand and contract what the herd is? Will disparities in who has access to vaccines locally, globally, keep moving the target? And what does that mean for who's safe, how, and when right here at home? We have questions, and we know you do too, so let's ask the doctors. What do you need to know this week about the coronavirus, vaccines, safe behaviors, indoors and outdoors? 800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today, we have Dr. Joshua Barocas. infectious disease physician at the Boston Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, an assistant professor at the Boston University School of Medicine. Drs. Barocas, Pierre, welcome back. Thank you.
Yeah,
lovely to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Pierre, was herd immunity ever actually possible?
Well, at some point, it did seem like it would be attainable when we thought that we needed maybe 60 to 70% of people to be vaccinated to attain it. Those margins, those numbers changed, as you mentioned, with variants that made the virus more highly transmissible. But to be honest, I think there's always been this concern that we would have uneven vaccination right here in the United States, where we have had disparities in rollout. Lack of access, especially to the hardest hit communities, those with more structurally marginalized individuals. And then globally, because what's global affects us locally. If the rest of the world is not expecting to get their first vaccines, or the majority of countries are not expected to get their first vaccines by 2022, then variants of concern will be continuing and threatening our vaccine and naturally derived immunity here in the United States. So it was a beautiful thing to look forward to. But unfortunately, the patterns of infection and the uneven distribution of this vaccine has really imperiled, not completely eradicated that dream.
So Dr. Barocas, should it no longer be the goal?
You know, I think that Americans generally need something. Something to hang our hat on, something to work for, toward. I think that the goal really should be protecting as many people from serious illness as we can. And that means striving for some amount of herd immunity, but also, and I think more importantly, we have, as Dr. Pierre said, I think we have to come to terms with the fact that we now have an endemic virus, and an endemic virus meaning something that we just live with, like the flu, that we may need updated vaccines, boosters, et cetera. And my concern, honestly, is that with endemic viruses, with endemic diseases, as Dr. Pierre said, it is the structurally marginalized. It's what we would call the global South that end up being the hardest hit, where the mortality and the morbidity are the most impactful, where there can be just vast economic devastation. And so I think that our goal really should be looking globally right now as how we can decrease the amount of essentially destruction that we have going on.
All right, we have lots of calls coming in. I'd like to go ahead and get started taking some of those. 1-800-423-8255 to ask Drs. Pierre and Barocas your questions. We have Danielle on the line from Brighton. Danielle, what's your question?
Hi. Now that I am fully vaccinated and 2 weeks out post-inoculation, can I stop wearing double masks, or do I need to keep wearing them?
Dr. Pierre.
That's a great question, Danielle. You know, recently there has been some questions about double masking in terms of its actual protection. And we're seeing that, you know, it really depends on the kind of double masking you're doing. I would actually just forego talking about double masking in general and say that the rates of transmission and COVID positivity in our community, in the Commonwealth, in New England, have decreased significantly. The amount of people that we are seeing vaccinated in our area, although again, not achieving herd immunity, has increased significantly. And so I do not think that people need to double mask at this point, especially as we talk about things like foregoing or ending the mask mandates when going out in non-congested areas. I don't think it's necessary at this point. And many people, unfortunately, may have been double masking in ways that may not have actually been as protective as they thought.
So, Dr. Barocas, the next question comes from Maggie in Brookline, and Maggie wants to know about if first dose is Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and then later, if boosters are required, can you get an mRNA booster? So meaning, for example, Moderna and Pfizer, and if so, would that make a difference?
Ooh, such a good question. To Maggie, I'm glad that you got something. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is an excellent vaccine that I think has gone through very rigorous testing. And as everyone knows, there was a pause on the rollout because of concerns of some increase in blood clots. But right now we are recommending, and I just say this so that everyone knows, we are recommending that whatever vaccine is available to you, that you take. There are vaccine clinics throughout the Commonwealth right now, and everyone who's an adult is eligible. Now, as far as boosters, a great question. We don't know right this second who's going to, if we're going to need boosters. And so it's a little premature to answer the question of boosting with, if you got Johnson & Johnson, whether you can boost with an mRNA vaccine like the Moderna or Pfizer or vice versa. Little early to tell. So I can't answer that right now, but I think that data will be forthcoming as far as whether or not we're going to need boosting.
1-800-423-8255 to ask a question of your own. We've got Quinn on the line in Brockton. Quinn, go ahead.
Hi, I missed my second dose of the vaccine voluntarily because I had an important event on the time that I was supposed to get my second vaccine. I do work with special needs kids, and I know that it's important to get my second vaccine. Is it still okay that I've missed the time frame?
Quinn, which vaccine, please? Do you know? Do you remember?
Moderna.
Thanks. Dr. Pierre?
Quinn, thank you for calling in with this question. I think many people are in this situation where they've either delayed or missed their second dose. And we are highly encouraging of people going and getting their second dose. Many people are saying, or experts are saying, between 8 to, even if it's within 8 to 12 weeks of the time that you were supposed to get your second dose, that you should expect to have really great efficacy with that second dose, even if it is delayed. So yes, I would highly encourage you to get that second dose to get better optimal protection for yourself and for the people that you take care of.
And Dr. Pierre, I can just imagine a listener out there saying, okay, what if for me it was, let's say, 16 weeks?
I would still recommend, now the evidence, we don't have evidence to say necessarily what percentage of the full efficacy you would get in taking your vaccine at 16 weeks after, you were scheduled to have taken it. But yes, I would still recommend doing it. It would still provide a boosting phenomena. So yes, please get it.
All right, let's take another call here. We have Dottie on the line in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Dottie, go ahead with your question.
Hi. This is Dottie. I have a question because both my husband and I had COVID itself, the disease, in January, and we're now recovered from it. And we're getting conflicting answers from our doctors when we talk to them about whether we also get the vaccine, because we were told that we have the natural immunity for eight months. Okay, my sister-in-law also had COVID, and she did get the vaccine. She had a terrible reaction to it. So I don't want that. So give me your thoughts, please.
Dr. Barocas, can we turn to you for Dottie?
Yeah, Dottie, I'm sorry to hear that that you were sick. I'm glad that you and your husband are doing well and recovered right now. So for people that have had COVID, and you're right, it was confusing. It is confusing. We were saying things earlier when we didn't really have a ton of vaccine available, and that was the reason for maybe waiting. At this point, you're fully recovered. You should absolutely go get the vaccine, whether it's the Johnson & Johnson or the Moderna or the Pfizer. Now, the second part of your question, it's important for us to be honest here. One of the things is that, especially in people who have had COVID, you might not feel so good after one of your vaccines, either if you get the Johnson & Johnson, the one shot, or if you get the Moderna or Pfizer after both of them, you might have a sore arm. You might have, you know, cold and flu-like symptoms that usually last no more than 24 hours. I can tell you that in my case, for instance, I didn't feel so great after my second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. I felt like maybe I had a little bit of the flu. That said, all of that passes. And whereas you are definitely still at risk for COVID, getting it again at some point, and this will certainly lessen the effects. So I would say you are definitely eligible. And if you feel bad after the vaccine, you have my deepest condolences. I'm so sorry, but I do know that's generally how some people feel.
Thanks for that, Dr. Barocas. We have more calls, so let's just stay with them. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your vaccine and coronavirus questions. We have Kathleen on the line in Shrewsbury. Kathleen, go ahead.
Hi. My nephew has a history of blood clots, and he's now on Eliquis. Would that be better for him then to get the Johnson & Johnson if he's already on Eliquis, or should he go for the other two instead?
Dr. Pierre, and let's broaden that for people with histories of blood clots. How should they think about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Yeah, that's a really important thing to talk about. You know, the interesting thing about Johnson & Johnson and the people, the 15 or potentially more people that have experienced those rare complications that we think about when we think about the pause that happened with Johnson & Johnson, the cerebral venous thrombosis, is that they didn't actually see any of those individuals having underlying histories of predisposition to clotting. And the other thing that's important, specifically for Kathleen, is that we did not see men post-trial develop these rare kinds of blood clots. So I think there is kind of a decision tree to make in, you know, for people who are men or women over the age of 50, whether they have clotting disorder or not. We're not really seeing an increased risk for these cases, these rare complications of COVID, of the blood clotting with Johnson & Johnson. And for women who are less than 50, that's where we are seeing some of these events. They are incredibly rare. The risk of COVID-19 related blood clots or, you know, hospitalization, severe complications of COVID-19 and death still outweigh the risks of those complications. That being said, we do have these other choices for women under the age of 50, should they wish to choose another option, the mRNA vaccines, which are not associated with these rare conditions. So all in all, just to answer the question, individuals who have an underlying clotting disorder are not believed, based on the data that we have, to have an increased risk of clotting because of taking the Johnson & Johnson. But that being said, we always have options. So this is a conversation that I always recommend people have with a doctor that they trust, with a medical provider that they trust, to go through this a little bit more. But as far as the data, we are not seeing any increased risk of clotting with that.
And Dr. Pierre, to be clear, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there at the end. To be clear, there's a new study out from the University of Oxford that found that the risk of clotting is 8 to 10 times higher from having COVID-19 than from getting it from a vaccine. Is that your understanding of the new research?
That's correct. We are seeing increased risk of, and we've known this for quite some time, that COVID-19 is associated with abnormal clotting complications, including that rare complication of the cerebral venous thrombosis. We are not entirely seeing the entire syndrome that we saw with Johnson & Johnson, which is having that rare clotting, that unusual location for clotting with low platelet counts. So that's an important consideration to make. It is rare, you know, we're not seeing that, but we are definitely seeing increased clotting. And we're also seeing an increased amount of all the complications people have been worried about the vaccines, which are not related to the vaccines. For example, issues with pregnancy loss, issues with longstanding complications. There are so many more reasons to be concerned about COVID-19, a laundry list, when we are seeing very, very rare complications in the double digits with the COVID-19 vaccines.
Let's go to Mary in Salem. Mary, what's your question?
Yeah, I haven't gotten the vaccine yet because I'm leery of it, because I had an adverse reaction to an MRI contrast digadolinium. So Do you think you can convince me to get the vaccine?
Oh, Dr. Brokus, it's on.
Mary, I can absolutely turn on the charm. Hopefully that helps. I think that the most important point that Dr. Pierre just brought up, as clinicians, both of us, and I don't want to speak for Dr. Pierre, but we are very close colleagues. We have seen just the absolute devastation front and center that the virus can cause. And we have donned our PPE, we've reused our masks, we've been at the bedside with families, and it is absolutely devastating. I 100% understand that people are like you are leery of the vaccine, and there are a lot of questions out there. I can say that this is something that I have gotten myself, that I have I recommend for my mother and my father, who I like and I love. So I want them to get it. I wanted them to get it and they got it. It's something that I trust. You and I don't know each other, but the potential side effects in a monitored setting of the vaccine, which can happen, but are very, very rare, are much more rare and B, much less devastating than the higher risk and the potential higher severity of COVID-19 disease itself. I know that there's a lot of questions, there are a lot of things, different sources of information floating out there, but my true, truly, I would want nothing more than for you or any family member of mine to be protected so that we don't have to keep going through what Dr. Pierre and I have seen at the bedside.
Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Brokus. We will not have time to get to more calls, although the lines were full. Listeners, you know we will do this again. Dr. Pierre, lightning round, one sentence. One caller did ask a question we've been hearing a lot. If I don't have a side effect from the vaccine, does that mean it didn't work?
Absolutely not.
There you go. Yeah, I love the good one sentence answer. All right, that is Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Joshua Brokus, an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center as well. They're both on faculty at Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you both of you for the generosity of your time and your information today. We appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
And listeners, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Janie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. And we have help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Great to talk to you. Thank you for calling and listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.